What I would like to do is just a little sampling of some of my favorite poets and then an Australian short story, which the group on Thursday morning unanimously urged me to read for a slightly wider audience. At supper time, I recited for you a little ditty by a Roman poet, and there's another one. These old Romans weren't quite so far away from us as we sometimes think they were. This is by the poet Martial, and the title is A Hinted Wish. You told me, Morrow, that whilst you live, you'd not a single penny give, but that, whene'er you chanced to die, you'd leave a handsome legacy. You must be mad beyond redress, if my next wish you cannot guess. A poet whose work I really enjoy is George Herbert. He wrote only religious poetry, but very meaningful spiritually. He lived 1593 to 1633, dying when he was only 40 years old. He was ordained in, I believe it was 1630, just shortly before his death. And one of his concerns as a parish pastor was to make sure that members of the congregation understood and knew the doctrines and teachings of the church. He wrote a long collection called The Church Porch, which consists of 77 little stanzas, each with a lesson or a message for guidance in living the Christian life. And I'd like to read two of those to you. Man is God's image, but a poor man is Christ's stamp to boot. Both images regard. God reckons for him, counts the favor his. Right, so much given to God, thou shalt be heard. Let thy offerings go before, and keep heaven's gate open for thee, or both may come too late. And urging the people to make sure that they tithed and gave to the church. The other one has a little moral lesson to it, and I think you can catch on to what he's telling the people. Drink not the third glass, which thou canst not tame when once it is within thee, but before may rule it as thou list. Pour the shame which it would pour on thee upon the floor. It is most just to throw that on the ground which would throw me there if I drink the round. One of our great American poets, who is in fact international in the sense that what she has written knows no boundaries of time or place, is Emily Dickinson, The Belle of Amherst, 1830 to 1886. During her lifetime, only 7 of her poems were published, but upon her death, when her sister was going through her room, she found almost 2,000 poems, some of them completed and neatly tied up in boxes, and others in various stages of completion and revision. I'd like to read two of hers for you tonight. The first one is called Chartless, and chart here is used in the sense of a navigation chart or a map. I never saw a moor, I never saw the sea, yet I know how heather looks and what a wave must be. I never spoke with God nor visited in heaven, yet certain am I of the spot as if the chart were given. Emily was very much affected by deaths of several people close to her within a fairly short span. Her father died in 1874, and 4 close friends within a 3-year period. Then her mother in 1882, and her nephew, who was very dear to her, in 1883. And this little poem is a comment on the death of a loved one. My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a 3rd event to me, so huge, so hopeless to conceive, as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven, and all we need of hell. Walt Whitman, the son of Manhattan, I really admire many of his works. Most of the ones that are my favorites of his are very long, so I won't read one of those. I'll read a shorter one that seems really meaningful here at Holden, where the air is so clear at night and one can see so many more stars than are visible in the city. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Robert Frost was the first American poet who to be invited to read at an inauguration of United States President. John F. Kennedy invited him to read some of his own works. His work almost needs no comment. One that I would like to read for you is called Design, and it brings into question how things happen. He asks the question, do things really happen by intent, by design, or is there an element of chance, an element of accident? One word that you might need to know is heal-all. Heal-all is one of several plants that are supposed to have healing powers. They have tightly clustered violet-blue flowers, but as you'll see, he refers in the poem to a white heal-all, something that is a freak out of the ordinary. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heal-all, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight, mixed ready to begin the morning rite, like ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower-like froth, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white? The wayside blue and innocent heal-all. What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but the design of darkness to appall, if design governed in a thing so small? Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to know that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Have you ever had the feeling that you were born at the wrong time, that you should have been born earlier or waited a few more years or centuries? Well, then you'll know what Minerva Chivi is all about. This is a little ditty written by Edward Arlington Robinson, a New England poet, 1869 through 1935. Minerva Chivi, child of scorn, grew lean while he assailed the seasons. He wept that he was ever born, and he had reasons. Minerva loved the days of old when swords were bright and steeds were prancing. The vision of a warrior bold would set him dancing. Minerva sighed for what was not, and dreamed and rested from his labors. He dreamed of Thebes and Camelot and Priam's neighbors. Minerva mourned the ripe renown that made so many a name so fragrant. He mourned romance, now on the town, and art, a vagrant. Minerva loved the Medici, albeit he had never seen one. He would have sinned incessantly, could he have been one. Minerva cursed the commonplace and eyed a pinstriped suit with loathing. He missed the medieval grace of iron clothing. Minerva scorned the gold he sought, but sore annoyed was he without it. Minerva thought and thought and thought and thought about it. Minervachivi, born too late, scratched his head and kept on thinking. Miniver coughed and called at fate and kept on drinking. There's a very short poem called Pastoral, written by John William Carrington, who is a Louisiana poet. The word pastoral refers to things relating to the country, rural matters. But another very fitting title for this one could be August 6, 1945. In the fields where larks emoted, where tender summer groomed green children, and the miraculous sea wove its breath among parvenu leaves, tiny cattle strolled in the circle of a wooden bell. Along a stream wound silver through rare trees. My God, Farmer Surakawa gasped, the breath of Armageddon on his neck, and turned to see a brook leap into steam. Cattle tumble, their delicate legs snapped like hoofed matchsticks. Leaves puff white to sift on fields of glass as larks burst into flame. And on the August horizon, the city being eaten by a sun. E.E. Cummings has written some really neat things, and I'd like to read to you my two favorite things of his, but I'm not going to tell you which one is the first, the first favorite. Nobody loses all the time. I had an uncle named Saul who was a born failure, and nearly everyone said he should have gone into vaudeville, perhaps because my uncle Saul could sing "McCann He Was a Diver" on Christmas Eve like hell itself. Which may or may not account for the fact that my Uncle Saul indulged in that possibly most inexcusable of all, to use a highfalutin phrase, luxuries. That is, or to wit, farming. And be it needlessly added, my Uncle Saul's farm failed because the chickens ate the vegetables. So my Uncle Saul had a chicken farm till the skunks ate the chickens. When my Uncle Saul had a skunk farm, but the skunks caught cold and died. So my Uncle Saul imitated the skunks in a subtle manner, or by drowning himself in the water tank. But somebody who'd given my Uncle Saul a Victor Victrola and records while he lived presented to him upon the auspicious occasion of his decease a scrumptious, not to mention splendiferous funeral, with tall boys in black gloves and flowers and everything. And I remember we all cried like the Missouri when my Uncle Saul's coffin lurched because somebody pressed a button. And down went my Uncle Saul and started a worm farm. Remember the title, Nobody Loses All the Time. I thank you, God, for most of this amazing day. For the leaping greenly spirits of trees and the blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay great happening illimitably earth. How should touching, tasting, hearing, seeing, breathing any lifted from the know of nothing, human merely being, doubt, unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. And I couldn't have any reading without something of Gerard Manley Hopkins. God's grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, Oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with... Spence mentioned at supper time that I had had my early education in Australia. My father is American, born in Nebraska and raised in South Dakota, but my mother is an Australian, raised in a small country town about 50 miles southwest of Brisbane in the state of Queensland. And they met in New Guinea and married, and that's where I was born and had my early education under the Australian school system. So I'm familiar with names like Banjo Patterson and Henry Lawson and C.J. Dennis. I knew those names before I knew Henry Wadsworth Longfellow or Ralph Waldo Emerson. There are a few Australian poems that I would like to share with you, and then a couple of short stories. One of the worst things you can say to an Australian is to comment on the nice English accent. It is not an English accent any more than American is an English accent. They have developed their own speech patterns and habits, and when you are accustomed to the accent, it is quite different from the typical English accent. There's standard Australian, which is the language spoken by radio announcers and news readers, and probably lawyers and other professional people during the course of their duties. And then there's the Australian that's spoken by everybody else and which you may have difficulty understanding. Fortunately, the things that I'm going to read to you tonight are in standard Australian, so you won't have any trouble with them. There are some rather hilarious stories told of people who go to Australia, especially Europeans, who have studied English and think they know the language and arrive on Australian shores to be totally and completely mystified and unable to comprehend anything that they hear around them. I'm sure that all of you know, whether you're aware of it or not, but you know the work of at least one Australian poet, and that's A.B. Banjo Patterson, who wrote the words to Waltzing Matilda. And I think everybody knows that one. Did any of you happen to see the movie about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, The Man from Snowy River?
Yes.
Okay. That was based on a poem, The Man from Snowy River, which was written by Banjo Patterson. And if you remember, he figured in it. He was the lawyer who gave the young boy the letter that referred him to the station owner for a job. Another figure in that movie was Clancy of The Overflow, the horseman who insisted that the young boy be permitted to go along on the search for the missing colt. Patterson's poetry is characterized by a very strong rhythm, which you will hear in this poem, Clancy of the Overflow. A couple of words that you might need to know. When an Australian talks about a mate, it has absolutely nothing to do with biology. Your mate is simply your good friend. The people you work with are your mates. Your mates may call you a flaming idiot or something worse, but if anybody else would dare to cast any aspersions whatsoever upon your character or integrity or intelligence, the mate would probably give them a knuckle sandwich. So your mate is your good friend, the person you work with and spend time with. A drover is a person, I hesitate to say cowboy because drovers also drove sheep, but it was a person who would go around to small land holdings and pick up the 100 or so cattle or sheep, whatever the small farmer had to sell, and he would pick up a large mob of animals and take them to the railhead to be sold. The large properties, the large stations could afford to hire a person to do that. But the small farms where perhaps there was just one family and no hired people at all couldn't do that, nor could they spare a member of the family to take the animals to the railhead for sale. So a drover would come around at the proper time of the year and pick up any animals and take them off to the railhead. When an Australian speaks of bush, he means out in the country, especially if it's remote. If this were Australia, Holden would be out in the bush. came, Clancy of the Overflow. I had written him a letter which I had, for want of better knowledge, sent to where I met him down the Loughlin years ago. He was shearing when I knew him, so I sent the letter to him, just on spec, addressed as follows, Clancy of the Overflow. And an answer came directed in a writing unexpected, and I think the same was written with a thumbnail dipped in tar. 'Twas his shearing mate who wrote it, and verbatim I will quote it. Clancy's gone to Queensland droving, and we don't know where he are. In my wild erratic fancy, visions come to me of Clancy, gone a-droving down the Cooper where the western drovers go. As the stock are slowly stringing, Clancy rides behind them singing, for the drover's life has pleasures that the townsfolk never know. And the bush has friends to meet him, and their kindly voices greet him in the murmur of the breezes and the river on its bars. And he sees the vision splendid of the sunlit plains extended, and at night the wondrous glory of the everlasting stars. I'm sitting in my dingy little office where a stingy ray of sunlight struggles feebly down between the houses tall, and the fetid air and gritty of the dusty, dirty city through the open window floating spreads its foulness over all. And in place of lowing cattle, I could hear the fiendish rattle of the tramways and the buses making hurry down the street. And the language uninviting of the gutter children fighting comes fitfully and faintly through the ceaseless tramp of feet. And the hurrying people daunt me, and their pallid faces haunt me as they shoulder one another in their rush and nervous haste, with their eager eyes and greedy, and their stunted forms and weedy, for the townsfolk have no time to grow, they have no time to waste. And somehow I rather fancy that I'd like to change with Clancy, like to take a turn at droving where the seasons come and go, while he faced the round eternal of the cash book and the journal. But I doubt he'd suit the office, Clancy of the Overflow. Australia is a very, very dry country. The average annual rainfall is 17 inches, and there are vast areas of the nation that receive 10 inches a year or less. In fact, parts of the interior, there may not be any rainfall in a particular year. So water is of great concern. Much of the underground water, especially in the outback, in the interior of the country, is heavily mineralized and not really fit for human consumption. So a corrugated iron tank or a cistern of some kind was tremendously important to catch the rain when it did fall, because in many cases that was the only water that people had available to them. So I'd like to read you a poem by James Haxton called Our Corrugated Iron Tank. Our tank stood on a crazy stand, bare to the burning sky, white hot as glares the desert sand, and dismal to the eye. Its lid was like a rakish hat, the tap all bent awry, and with a drip so constant, it almost dripped when dry. It was the most convenient tank wherein most things could fall, where snakes came from the bush and drank, the rabbits used to call, the mice committed suicide, the gum leaves sank to rest, and in it possums dropped and died, and hornets made their nest. But stark within my memory, I see it once again, when we looked at it anxiously, days when we hoped for rain. I hear the hollow sounds it made, like some prophetic drum, as I tapped rung on rung, afraid of dreadful days to come. When mother in despair would pray, as low the water sank, four rungs, three rungs, two rungs, and I, how miserly we drank. And there was none for face or hands, waste was a wicked thing. There in the baked and parching lands, with hope our only spring. Next came the fatal one rung left. How cruel words can be, as we stood of all joys bereft, dumb in our misery. And then I tapped the tank in pain, those knells of drought and doom, our tank at last gone dry again, our home cast down in gloom. But oh, the joy that filled our hearts when came the bounteous rain, and the drainpipe sang in fits and starts and filled the tank again. We felt as if we'd riches won, that life again was sweet, and overjoyed then everyone. We even washed our feet. I don't have any dates at all for the Australian poetess Dorothea McKellar, but she must have lived and written early in the century, because I know my cousins who went to school in the 1930s know this particular poem, which I would like to read to you, which expresses a great love for Australia and a love for the new unique country that it is. It's entitled My Country. The only term you might need to know is the word paddock, which means any pasture or field. The love of fields and coppices, of green and shaded lanes, of ordered woods and gardens is running in your veins. Strong love of gray blue distance, brown streams and soft dim skies. I know but cannot share it. My love is otherwise. I love a sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains, of ragged mountain ranges, of droughts and flooding rains. I love her far horizons. I love her jewel sea, her beauty and her terror, the wide brown land for me. The tragic ring-barked forests, stark white beneath the moon, the sapphire-misted mountains, the hot gold hush of noon, green tangle of the brushes where lithe lianas coil, and orchids deck the treetops, and ferns the crimson soil. Core of my heart, my country, her pitiless blue sky, when sick at heart around us we see the cattle die, but when the gray clouds gather and we can bless again the drumming of an army, the steady soaking rain. Core of my heart, my country, land of the rainbow gold, of flood and fire and famine, she pays us back threefold. Over the thirsty paddocks watch, after many days, the filmy veil of greenness that thickens as we gaze. An opal-hearted country, a willful, lavish land. All you who have not loved her, you will not understand. Though earth holds many splendors, wherever I may die, I know to what brown country my homing thoughts will fly. You all know what kangaroos are like. I'm sure that you've seen them in zoos or at least in pictures. I have never seen a herd of wild kangaroos hopping across a grassy plain, but this next poem by William Hart Smith evokes the image very nicely. It's called Kangaroos. Brown out of the brown tussock, a darker brown head rises, as if thrust up cautiously on a pole. A green bird on a feathering grass stem that bends under its weight flutters and sinks out of sight. It is the only disturbance except for the reiterated clicking of castanets and the fife notes of insects. One notices the head gone, pulled down out of sight like the vanished bird. But all over the unfurled map of the landscape, minute brown figures, dots, jump, all diminishing, yet each pursuing lines that intersect, making a maze of crazy map lines, meaningless angles. The skin of the land is a deep fur, maddeningly come alive with deliberate great fleas. Judith Wright has achieved some fame as a poet in Australia, and I happen to know that she is still living because she lives at Tambourine, which is up in the mountains about 15 miles into the ranges from where my parents live. When I was last in Australia in 1982, I took a bus tour with one of my cousins up into the mountains, and the driver pointed out to us the road down which Judith Wright lived. She has written a series of poems on birds, and she says that the bird has originally given her the idea or the initial image for the poem, and she has gone on from there, and the poem is not necessarily about the particular bird, but the image is a fitting one for whatever she wants to say. This one is called Black Cockatoos.
Each certain kind of weather or of life has its own creatures. Somewhere else they wait, as though they but inhabited heat or cold, twilight or dawn, and knew no other state. Then at their time they come, timid or bold. So when the long drought winds, sandpaper harsh, were still, and the air changed and the clouds came, and other birds were quiet in prayer or fear, these knew their hour. Before the first far flash lit up, or the first thunder spoke its name, in heavy flight they came, till I could hear the wild black cockatoos tossed on the crest of their high trees, crying the world's unrest.
The story that I want to read for you is by Henry Lawson, who, with Banjo Paterson, are sort of the two grandfathers of Australian literature. Henry Lawson's dates are 1867 to 1922. The Bulletin was a literary journal published in Sydney, Australia, from the late 1800s, and just about all of the authors of note have gotten their start by being published in the Bulletin. Lawson and Paterson carried on sort of a printed debate in the Bulletin. Lawson criticized Paterson as a city bushman who wrote only of the happy and rollicking aspects of life in the country. And Paterson alleged that Lawson saw only the grim and gloomy side of living in the bush. Well, I think you'll agree after I finish the story that Lawson shows something other than the grim and gloomy side of life in the bush. A couple of words that it might be helpful for you to know. One of them is publican. This does not mean the same thing as it does in the Old Testament. A publican is a hotel keeper. And a hotel is not a hotel where people go to stay, although I think there are some legal restrictions on a minimum requirement of rooms and meals available if any traveler should be so foolish as to want to stay in a hotel. The main business of the hotel is the bar, the pub, where people go for their beer, which is very important in Australian life. So the publican then is the hotel keeper. Treacle is a kind of light molasses. In the story there's reference to a treacle tin. That's simply the tin that the molasses came in. Scrub is a noun, and it means brush or light woods, like you might find along a creek bank. You talk about the cows getting themselves lost in the scrub and having to have the dogs sent after them. It just means brush, undergrowth. The title of the story is The Loaded Dog. Dave Regan, Jim Bentley, and Andy Page were sinking a shaft at Stony Creek in search of a rich gold quartz reef which was supposed to exist in the vicinity. There is always a rich reef supposed to exist in the vicinity. The only questions are whether it is 10 feet or 100 beneath the surface and in which direction. They had struck some pretty solid rock, also water which kept them bailing. They used the old-fashioned blasting powder and time fuse. They'd make a sausage or cartridge of blasting powder in a skin of strong calico or canvas, the mouth sewn and bound around the end of the fuse. They'd dip the cartridge in melted tallow to make it watertight, get the drill hole as dry as possible, drop in the cartridge with some dry dust and wad and ram it with stiff clay and broken brick. Then they'd light the fuse and get out of the hole and wait. The result was usually an ugly pothole in the bottom of the shaft and half a barrel load of broken rock. There were plenty of fish in the creek, freshwater bream, cod, catfish, and tailors. The party were fond of fish, and Andy and Dave of fishing. Andy would fish for 3 hours at a stretch if encouraged by a nibble or a bite now and then, say once in 20 minutes. The butcher was always willing to give meat in exchange for fish when they caught more than they could eat. But now it was winter, and these fish wouldn't bite. However, the creek was low, just a chain of muddy water holes, from the hole with a few bucketfuls in it to the sizable pool with an average depth of 6 or 7 feet, and they could get fish by bailing out the smaller holes or by muddying up the water in the larger one
until the fish rose to the surface. There was the catfish, with spikes growing out of the sides of its head. And if you got pricked, you'd know it, as Dave said. Andy took off his boots, tucked up his trousers, and went into a hole one day to stir up the mud with his feet, and he knew it. Dave scooped out one with his hand and got pricked, and he knew it, too. His arm swelled, and the pain throbbed up into his shoulder and down into his stomach, too, he said, like a toothache he had once, and kept him awake for 2 nights. Only the toothache pain had a burred edge, Dave said. Dave got an idea. Why not blow up the fish in the big water hole with the cartridge, he said. I'll try it. He thought the thing out, and Andy Page worked it out. Andy usually put Dave's theories into practice, if they were practicable, or bore the blame for the failure and the chaffing of his mates, if they weren't. He made a cartridge about 3 times the size of those they used in the rock. Jim Bentley said it was big enough to blow the bottom out of the river. The inner skin was of stout calico. Andy stuck the end of a 6-foot piece of fuse well down in the powder and bound the mouth of the bag firmly to it with whipcord. The idea was to sink the cartridge in the water with the open end of the fuse attached to a float on the surface, ready for lighting. Andy dipped the cartridge in melted beeswax to make it watertight. We'll have to leave it some time before we light it, said Dave, to give the fish time to get over the scare when we put it in and come nosing around again, so we'll want it well watertight. Around the cartridge, Andy, at Dave's suggestion, bound a strip of sail canvas that they used for making water bags to increase the force of the explosion, and around that he pasted layers of stiff brown paper on the plan of the sort of fireworks we called gun crackers. He let the paper dry in the sun, then he sewed a covering of 2 thicknesses of canvas over it, and bound the thing from end to end with stout fishing line. Dave's schemes were elaborate, and he often worked his inventions out to nothing. The cartridge was rigid and solid enough now, a formidable bomb, but Andy and Dave wanted to be sure. Andy sewed on another layer of canvas, dipped the cartridge in melted tallow, twisted a length of fencing wire around it as an afterthought, dipped it in tallow again, and then stood it carefully against a tent peg, where he'd know where to find it, and wound the fuse loosely around it. Then he went to the campfire to try some potatoes which were boiling in their jackets in the billy, and to see about frying some chops for dinner. Dave and Jim were at work at the claim that morning. They had a big black young retriever dog, or rather an overgrown pup, a big, foolish, 4-footed mate who was always slobbering around them and lashing their legs with his heavy tail that swung around like a stock whip. Most of his head was usually a red, idiotic, slobbering grin of appreciation of his own silliness. He seemed to take life, the world, his 2-legged mates, and his own instinct as a huge joke. He'd retrieve anything. He carted back most of the camp rubbish that Andy threw away. They had a cat that died in hot weather, and Andy threw it a good distance away in the scrub. And early one morning, the dog found the cat, after it had been dead a week or so, and carried it back to camp and laid it just inside the tent flaps, where it could best make its presence known when the mates should rise and begin to sniff suspiciously in the sickly, smothering atmosphere of the summer sunrise. He used to retrieve them when they went in swimming. He'd jump in after them and take their hands in his mouth and try to swim out with them and scratch their naked bodies with his paws. They loved him for his good-heartedness and his foolishness, but when they wished to enjoy a swim, they had to tie him up in camp. He watched Andy with great interest all the morning, making the cartridge, and hindered him considerably, trying to help. But about noon, he went off to the claim to see how Dave and Jim were getting on, and to come home to dinner with them. Andy saw them coming, and put a panful of mutton chops on the fire. Andy was cooked today. Dave and Jim stood with their backs to the fire, as bushmen do in all weathers, waiting till dinner should be ready. The retriever went nosing around after something he seemed to have missed. Andy's brain still worked on the cartridge. His eye was caught by the glare of an empty kerosene tin lying in the bushes, and it struck him that it wouldn't be a bad idea to sink the cartridge packed with clay, sand, or stones in the tin to increase the force of the explosion. He may have been all out from a scientific point of view, But the notion looked all right to him. Jib Bentley, by the way, wasn't interested in their damned silliness. Andy noticed an empty treacle tin, the sort with the little tin neck or spout soldered onto the top for the convenience of pouring up the treacle, and it struck him that this would have made the best kind of cartridge case. He would only have had to pour in the powder, stick the fuse in through the neck, and cork and seal it with beeswax. He was turning to suggest this to Dave when Dave glanced over his shoulder to see how the chops were doing and bolted. He explained afterwards that he thought he heard the pan spluttering extra and looked to see if the chops were burning. Jim Bentley looked behind and bolted after Dave. Andy stood rock still, staring after them. "Run, Andy, run!" they shouted back at him. "Run! Look behind you, you fool!" Andy turned slowly and looked, and there, close behind him, was the retriever with the cartridge in his mouth, wedged into his broadest and silliest grin. And that wasn't all. The dog had come around the fire to Andy, and the loose end of the fuse had trailed and waggled over the burning sticks into the blaze. Andy had slit and nicked the firing end of the fuse well, and now it was hissing and spitting properly. Andy's leg started with a jolt. His leg started before his brain did, and he made after Dave and Jim, and the dog followed Andy. Dave and Jim were good runners, Jim the best for a short distance. Andy was slow and heavy, but he had the strength and the wind and could last. The dog capered around him, delighted as a dog could be, to find his mates, as he thought, on for a frolic. Dave and Jim kept shouting back, "Don't follow us! Don't follow us, you so-and-so fool!" But Andy kept on, no matter how they dodged. They could never explain any more than the dog why they followed each other. But so they ran, Dave keeping in Jim's track in all its turnings, Andy after Dave, and the dog circling around Andy, the live fuse swishing in all directions and hissing and spluttering and stinking. Jim yelling to Dave not to follow him, Dave shouting to Andy to go in another direction to spread out, and Andy roaring at the dog to go home. Then Andy's brain began to work, stimulated by the crisis. He tried to get a running kick at the dog, but the dog dodged. He snatched up sticks and stones and threw them at the dog and ran on again. The retriever saw that he'd made a mistake about Andy and left him and bounded after Dave. Dave, who had presence of mind to think that the fuse's time wasn't up yet, made a dive and a grab for the dog, caught him by the tail, and as he swung around, snatched the cartridge out of his mouth and flung it as far as he could. Dog immediately bounded after it and retrieved it. Dave roared and cursed at the dog, who, seeing that Dave was offended, left him and went after Jim, who was well ahead. Jim swung to a sapling and went up it like a native bear. But it was a young sapling, and Jim couldn't safely get more than 10 or 12 feet from the ground. The dog laid the cartridge as carefully as if it were a kitten at the foot of the sapling and capered and leaped and whooped joyously around under Jim. The big pup reckoned that this was part of the lark. He was all right now. It was Jim who was out for a spree. The fuse sounded as if it were going a mile a minute. Jim tried to climb higher, and the sapling bent and cracked. Jim fell on his feet and ran. The dog swooped on the cartridge and followed. It all took but a very few moments. Jim ran to a digger's hole about 10 feet deep and dropped down into it, landing on soft mud, and was safe. The dog grinned sardonically down on him over the edge for a moment, as if he thought it would be a good lark to drop the cartridge down on Jim. "Go away, Tommy," said Jim feebly. "Go away." The dog bounded off after Dave, who was the only one in sight now. Andy had dropped down behind a log, where he lay flat on his face, having suddenly remembered a picture of the Russo-Turkish War, with a circle of Turks lying flat on their faces as if they were ashamed around a newly arrived shell. There was a small hotel or shanty on the creek, on the main road, not far from the claim. Dave was desperate. The time flew much faster in his stimulated imagination than it did in reality, so he made for the shanty. There were several casual bushmen on the veranda and in the bar. Dave rushed into the bar, banging the door to behind him. "My dog," he gasped, in reply to the astonished stare of the publican. "The blanky retriever, he's got a live cartridge in his mouth."
The retriever, finding the front door shut against him, had bounded around and in by the back way, and now stood smiling in the doorway leading from the corridor, the cartridge still in his mouth and the fuse spluttering. They burst out of that bar. Tommy bounded first after one and then after another, for, being a young dog, he tried to make friends with everybody. The bushmen ran around corners, and some shut themselves in the stable. There was a new weatherboard and corrugated iron kitchen and wash house on pilings in the backyard, with some women washing clothes inside. Dave and the publican bundled in there and shut the door, the publican cursing Dave and calling him a crimson fool in hurried tones and wanting to know what the hell he came here for. The retriever went in under the kitchen amongst the pilings, but luckily for those inside, there was a vicious yellow mongrel cattle dog skulking and nursing his nastiness under there, a sneaking, fighting, thieving canine whom the neighbors had tried for years to shoot or poison. Tommy saw his danger. He'd had experience from this dog, and he started out across the yard, still sticking to the cartridge. Halfway across the yard, the yellow dog caught him and nipped him. Tommy dropped the cartridge, gave one terrified yell, and took to the bush. The yellow dog followed him to the fence, and then ran back to see what he had dropped. Nearly a dozen other dogs came from around all the corners and under the buildings, spidery, thievish, cold-blooded kangaroo dogs, mongrel sheep and cattle dogs, vicious black and yellow dogs that slip after you in the dark, nip your heels, and then vanish without explaining, and yapping, yelping small fry. They kept at a respectable distance around the nasty yellow dog, for it was dangerous to go near him when he thought he had found something that was good for a dog or a cat. He sniffed at the cartridge twice and was just taking a third cautious sniff when... It was very good blasting powder, a new brand that Dave had recently got up from Sydney, and the cartridge had been excellently well made. Andy was very patient and painstaking in all he did, and nearly as handy as the average sailor with needles, twine, canvas, and rope. Bushmen say that the kitchen jumped off its pilings and on again. When the smoke and dust cleared away, the remains of the nasty yellow dog were lying against the paling fence of the yard, looking as if he had been kicked into a fire by a horse and afterwards rolled in the dust under a barrow and finally thrown against the fence from a distance. Several saddle horses, which had been hanging around the veranda, were galloping wildly down the roads in clouds of dust, with broken bridle reins flying. And from a circle around the outskirts, from every point of the compass in the scrub, came the yelping of dogs. Two of them went home to the place where they were born, 30 miles away, and reached it the same night, and stayed there. It was not until towards evening that the rest came back cautiously to make inquiries. One was trying to walk on two legs, and most of them looked more or less singed. And a little singed, stumpy-tailed dog, who had been in the habit of hopping the back half of him along on one leg, had reason to be glad that he'd saved up the other leg for all of those years, because he needed it now. There was one old one-eyed cattle dog around that shanty for years afterwards, who couldn't stand the smell of a gun being cleaned. He it was who had taken an interest only second to that of the yellow dog in the cartridge. Bushman said that it was amusing to slip up on his blind side and stick a dirty ramrod under his nose. He wouldn't wait to bring his solitary eye to bear. He'd take to the bush and stay out all night. For half an hour or so after the explosion, there were several bushmen around behind the stable who crouched doubled up against the wall or rolled gently in the dust, trying to laugh without shrieking. There were two white women in hysterics at the house and a half-caste rushing aimlessly around with a dipper of cold water. The publican was holding his wife tight and begging her between her squawks to hold up for my sake, Mary, or I'll lamb the life out of ye. Dave decided to apologize later on when things had settled a bit and went back to camp. And the dog that had done it all, Tommy, the great idiotic mongrel retriever, came slobbering around Dave and lashing his legs with his tail and trotted home after him, smiling his broadest, longest, and reddest smile of amiability, apparently satisfied for one afternoon with the fun that he'd had. Andy chained the dog up securely and cooked some more chops, while Dave went to help Jim out of the hole. And most of this is why, for years afterwards, lanky, easygoing bushmen riding lazily past Dave's camp would cry, in a lazy drawl, with just a hint of a nasal twang, "Hello, Dave. How's the fishing getting on, Dave?"